Hello, this is Ethan Nadelman. I'm the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and I want to welcome all of you who are online with us today to our web chat. We've done a number of these in the past with Ira Glasser, the head of the American Civil Liberties Union, who now chairs the Drug Policy Alliance, with some of my colleagues, with Eric Schlosser, and I'm absolutely delighted to have as our guest today two dear friends, two remarkable human beings, Sasha and Ann Shulgin. I mean, really, the outstanding pioneers in psychedelic research for so many years. They were just recently featured in the New York Times Magazine. Sasha has been an amazing explorer and pharmacologist and chemist, and Anne has been a beautiful writer and therapist. And they've been, I'm very glad to have them on our show today. So welcome, Sasha. Welcome, Anne.
Hi. Hello.
Yeah, and I remember we had you in New York for a live engagement a few months ago, and there was a wonderful crowd of about 100, 200 people there, including lots of young people who just really revered the way that you were pursuing your work and pursuing your research and such. So, you know, we've already received, before this chat, a whole series of questions that people have thrown at you and that people would like to ask. Some of these questions started off with ecstasy. And let me just pick one of the most interesting ones. You know, obviously, a lot of people listening have had extensive experience with ecstasy. One of the questions was, what's your sense of how ecstasy has evolved and emerged in American society since you essentially, you know, didn't invent it, but discovered its entheogenic uses?
Do you want to take that one?
I'll take it, yes. It has evolved, it has grown in use, and I think the growth in use, and it's the way it is being used, and it's, of course, being made a Schedule I illegal material, has probably robbed the medical society of one of the most valuable potential therapeutic tools in psychotherapy. It cannot be used in psychotherapy now because of its illegality, and this I saw as being the primary value of the material. So I believe this growth of use and the growth of illegality has, to a measure, robbed the medical community of a very valuable tool.
Right. Although there are some studies underway now. Isn't there something going on in South Carolina and something at Harvard? I mean, what can you tell us about those?
Let's see. As Sasha, you told me there's one MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in subjects with chronic treatment-resistant, whatever that means.
Well, actually, the MDMA is being a study. It's either been set up, being underway, or it's been completed in the use of MDMA in the treatment of anxiety associated with cancer, terminal cancer.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's not the PTSD.
That's the one that's being set up at Harvard.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then another one is the use of psilocybin in that same general thing where it's been used in a study, again, with anxiety associated with terminal cancer.
Yes, I guess there's the South Carolina study, right, that Michael and Ann Mithoffer are doing, PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome.
That's right, and that's a MAP-sponsored program in South Carolina.
That's right. It's been sponsored by the organization that was founded by Rick Doblin called MAPS. It's MAPS.org. It's a multidisciplinary association of psychedelic studies. You know, there was a wonderful little article just recently in the German magazine Der Spiegel called Ecstasy on the Battlefield, and they go, the U.S. government has found a new way of recruiting soldiers for the Iraq War. It's offering them ecstasy.
Oh.
Now, of course, what that's about is that I believe the government has approved allowing some people to enter the South Carolina study for treatment of their PTSD.
I believe in the South Carolina study that some 5 out of the 20 subjects have already completed the study.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't realize they're actually using that as an inducement to.
My guess, Ann, is that the magazine Der Spiegel was spoofing the whole thing a bit, you know. But it is interesting that, you know, there does appear, I mean, to be a slight green light moving forward for some research in this area. I mean, why do you think the government's finally gone along? I mean, clearly the persistence of Rick Doblin and MAPS has played a pivotal role in moving things forward. I mean, what else do you think's happening there?
Well, I track it back, though I may or may not be right, to the change in the media. There were years of melodramatic nonsense, mostly, about ecstasy, which, by the way, we really hate using the word, because ecstasy can be anything at all. What we use is MDMA. And there was a change when a young reporter, whose name escapes me at the moment, wrote a very good article for Time magazine.
John Cloud, I think that
John
was.
John Cloud, yes. Yes. And that was very good. It emphasized the psychotherapy aspect of the use of MDMA, and this had been something that mostly the television programs had completely overlooked or just barely mentioned.
Yeah.
I think that since John Cloud came out with that, there was a little ripple through the journalistic community, and I think the message was it's time to change the message.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to change.
Mm-hmm.
People were a little more willing to, I think Peter Jennings came along with a very good special after that.
Well, I remember, Ann, that Jennings was working on that special, and then that thing popped up where the leading sort of anti-ecstasy researcher, anti-MDMA researcher, Ricarte from Hopkins, and it turned out that he had done this study where he had accidentally given some animals amphetamine instead of MDMA, and then science remarkably published his study, even though it was inconsistent with all the pre-existing studies. And I think when that mistake was revealed, my guess is that must have helped push the pendulum back the other way as well.
I think you're right, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a very, very sad thing for Dr. Ricarte, but I think it did help to make people think twice.
You know what else I remember? I remember the three of us being at a gathering 10 years ago, I guess, about a whole week-long gathering about the issue of psychedelics. And one of the things that was interesting was that some of the people who were at this gathering and who were sympathetic to the psychedelics research are really quite well known for their support for the drug war. I mean, I won't mention any names, but some very prominent people who had previously served in the drug czar's office and were identified with very repressive policies. Nonetheless, you could see that in their younger days, they were aware of the research on LSD and other psychedelics going back to the 50s and early 60s, and they actually thought that there was, that there was stuff worth investigating there.
Sure. Yeah.
You know,
but
I mean,
what happens to the politicians is that they wait until they're out of office, and they're not planning to go back into office, and then they open up and say what they really feel and think.
Yeah.
But by that time, it's a bit late.
I mean, Sasha, what have you found? I mean, in terms of the more kind of quote-unquote mainstream biochemist and, you know, pharmacological community, do you find a kind of, are there a lot of closet interest in this or people who are aware of the old research? You know, what's your sense of that?
In the academic world, there are a surprisingly large number of people who are quite fascinated with the area and are appropriately afraid of the area. They're mm-hmm. fascinated because they do read things, they do hear other people speak about experiences that they find to be quite intriguing, and yet they're in an academic position of accepting grants from NIDA and from the government and from this and that, who would not either tolerate a study of this, in this area, or would be very patient with a person who was publicly speaking positively about it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great deal of politics that influences the academic world.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that came in from, there's one question from Darren Buss, another one from Michael Ruderman, and they're essentially asking, what about for younger people who are interested in doing psychedelics research? Is there a way to do it? Is there a future in this? How would you propose that they proceed?
Yeah.
Well, I think when I get this occasionally get this question from others, what can I do academically to get in the situation of doing this kind of research? And to me, the answer I always say is get yourself a college education, get yourself an advanced degree, preferably a PhD, in some area, biochemistry, chemistry, physiology, some area that can touch upon this area of research, and then take a postdoctorate study with someone to teach you the rules of research, not what you're looking at, but how you look at things. And with that background, then you can begin getting an academic position of your own and begin calling your own shot for your own research.
Are there any researchers around the country at the universities who stand out as being people who could mentor and advise these students?
Oh, there are researchers who are working in the area of psychedelic drugs, but not with human subjects.
Mm-hmm.
David Nichols at Purdue has been one of the most creative person, and there are many graduate students who have gone through his studies there,
right,
and have gone on in their own research.
Rick Strassman,
Charlie Grobe at UCLA.
Grobe down in Southern California.
And then is it John Halpern at Harvard?
Is it Harvard? Same role.
All three of those are psychiatrists. That's a good place to start.
Now, that's a medical degree, but at least get an academic degree in something that is in that scientific area.
Now, there's a bunch of questions here about ecstasy, because obviously millions and millions of Americans, have used these, and no doubt many of our listeners are familiar with it. Let me just throw a few of these questions at you. The first one is, why do you think music seems to play such a large role in the MDMA experience? Is there what's this connection with the rave culture? Is there any connection about the brain's response to music in MDMA?
Well, my thought is that music is absolutely magical under the influence of any psychedelic I can think of. Even to people who don't listen to music that much, listening. Of course, we prefer classical, the modern Russians, but listening to any music under the influence of these materials. Is a tremendously rich experience.
Right, so it's not just ecstasy, it's mushrooms, and it can be LSD and a whole range of things.
But one of the things with ecstasy, with MDMA, is that it does tend to drop your barriers a little bit. That's why it's so good in psychiatry, in psychopharmacology, in therapeutic work. You don't take a year to get a communication through your barriers to your physician.
Mm-hmm.
The barriers are dropped almost immediately, and music is, of course, in the rave scene, is interactions and dropping of the barriers makes the interaction much more smooth, and of course the music is much more part of the world.
Right. Well, now here's another question, which is a number of people have asked this. They say, I've used ecstasy or MDMA literally hundreds of times, lost count how many times I've used it, and I'm worried. I want to know. I see all this stuff out there. Is this going to cause any harm to me as I get older? Should I stop using it now? Do I have anything to worry about my children being affected? What's the current state of knowledge? This stuff we see about the occasional death, whether it's in the Bay Area or in England or wherever it might be, are these really, MDMA overdose deaths?
I personally don't believe there is a reputable threat of physical, psychological damage from MDMA on the large scale. There are individual idiosyncratic sensitivities, certainly.
But they're very rare.
Another thing that is often brought up is the neural damage or the serotonin receptor site damages. This has been shown in animals, but it's not been shown in man. Another point to bear out is the fact that many times the death associated with MDMA was the tripping at the top of a staircase and falling downstairs.
Mm-hmm.
And the because there was MDMA in the body, the MDMA is the cause of death in the autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes some young person who's not really very bright has taken MDMA along with three or four other drugs, and for some reason the media picks on the MDMA.
Another point also is the fact that with hundreds of uses, many uses, sometimes some people, not that many, the original magic of MDMA is lost.
Mm-hmm.
And people then tend to use more of it, trying to recapture the magic, and it is just about not recapturable.
And it is not. There's nothing that one can do to recapture the magic, essentially.
I don't know of it, no.
Well, there is actually something you can do, and that is, I know personally of one psychologist out here, and there must be others in the country, who specialize, or at least half of their practice is in taking in people, clients who have had the MDMA experience and loved it and want to recapture it, and under hypnosis they find out how to do that so that they don't have to take a chance with drugs that may or may not have any MDMA in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much safer legally, and this seems to have been very successful.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question from John Ubersax. He says, are there any legal substances that produce experiences similar or comparable to those of MDMA?
I'd be hesitant to give answers to a question like that, because if you do, if I were to say, yes, such and such is very much like MDMA, this could be immediately promoted into a crashing drive to synthesize, to sell, and I think it would be not to the community's advantage.
Okay. Now, for those of you who have recently tuned in, this is Ethan Nadelman. I'm the Executive Director of the Drug Policy Alliance. We're the leading organization in the U.S. and probably the world of people who believe that the war on drugs is doing more harm than good. We're a membership organization, and we depend upon contributions from all of you. So if you're not yet a member of the Drug Policy Alliance, please do hit that donate button on the DPA webpage there. Now, if you want to ask a question, what you can do is you just type it in on the bottom right of the auditorium page on the web page there. I am here chatting with Sasha and Ann Shulgin, the noted psychedelic researchers and chemists and therapists. And this next question is for you. The question really is, if you think back about all the sorts of therapeutic types of encounters and sessions you've done with people with where MDMA has played a role, are there any sorts of things that sort of stand out as breakthroughs or as really remarkable sessions in your recollection?
Yes, there are several. It's a little bit difficult to summarize sessions which may have taken 6 months to a year, but the one of the most startling one was with a gentleman who was having trouble with his legs, and he couldn't understand why he seemed to always have something happen to his legs. He had a small airplane crash, and the only thing hurt, though it was temporary, were his legs, etc. All this sort of thing went on, and he wondered if there's any way to find out why. And also, when he got into an airplane, he would have a great unease in his legs. So he had an MDMA session, which this is obviously before it was illegalized, and suddenly remembered that he had been, I think, 5 or 6 years old, and the elementary school he was in, there was, I don't know what it was, whether it was snow or some other weight on the ceiling, but the entire ceiling crashed in. And he sort of came to, standing in line with his little friends, with the teacher trying to keep everybody from being too panicked. And the only thing he could remember at that time was that his legs had been caught under the edge of his desk. And the entire trauma concentrated on his legs, even more so because when he got home, his family insisted that his mother insisted that nobody discuss this awful event. Put it out of your minds, and let's go on with our life. Of course, that sort of repression is the worst sort of thing you could do. So this was the first time he'd remembered this event was under MDMA, which opened up the entire memory.
And, you know, it sounds a lot when you talk about this. I mean, you hear sometimes similar experiences happening in very intense psychotherapy or body work or rolfing or holotropic breathing or sometimes other types of spiritual. I mean, what it sounds like in a way is that ecstasy or MDMA is one among a variety of tools that can help people get there, and perhaps it's oftentimes is a faster and easier way to get people there if they're able to do so responsibly.
Yeah, and what we found, the hypnotherapist I worked with for a couple of years, is that hypnotherapy works very well with the addition of MDMA. But when people ask me what can take the place of MDMA, one of the other answers is hypnotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
That also unlocks the same doors
mm-hmm.
that MDMA unlocks, one of those doors being to early memories.
Now, you know, I mean, you know, obviously back in the 50s, early 60s, there was all this research with psychedelics and psychotherapy and in dealing with, I mean, there were those famous studies dealing with prisoners and dealing with people suffering from alcoholism and a whole range of other things. And when you think, when you look at MDMA and compare it with, what was it, mescaline and other substances were used at, back then, what are or were the advantages and disadvantages of each of these?
Well, many of them had very, very strong advantages, primarily for the reason that Anne was saying, that they open up things that had been blocked because of mental worries or because of self-images. And these become available to think about, to use in your own world. On the other hand, this can occur with many psychedelics. The psychedelics present often a visual or a tactile or an auditory world that would tend to keep you from going into a therapeutic world, to a therapeutic study. Whereas MDMA has the advantage of not giving you much in the way of visual effects out there, but primarily one of warmth and of opening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the MDMA is not a psychedelic. Although the visual interpretations and visual changes, it can be quite nice, but it is really not a psychedelic at all. So, as Sasha says, you aren't taken out of your focus by a lot of fancy things happening on the walls.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess it also, I mean, it has this reputation for having this sort of loving quality about it, this heart-opening and pathogenic. I remember when I was doing the interview with the Peter Jennings show, although he didn't use this on his show, and, you know, he asked, well, what's it like? And I said, well, the thing you say about MDMA, especially the first time you take it, is that it makes you feel warmly towards strangers, lovingly towards friends, and profoundly in love with your lover. And it puts people in a place where they feel able to both hear and say things that normally all their defenses would go up against. And I think when, you know, with the psychedelics, those oftentimes are more powerful. I remember when people talked about doing these things and using these in psychotherapy, sometimes they would talk about using them in a low-dose form, sort of like MDMA has been used in psychotherapy.
Opening the door a little bit, but not letting the
right
run through it.
And then other times they would talk about giving the heavy dose to really knock people back and try to really create a profound alteration of consciousness and awareness.
Well, there's one thing that MDMA does particularly well and probably better than any other drug I know of, and that is that it allows you to really love and accept yourself, which is, after all, the basis for the loving of anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is it allows you to see all your faults and all your problems, but also that you are a treasure. And that this particular part of the MDMA experience is what liberates people who have been very closed in and are fighting self-hatred. So MDMA is still the exceptional drug for this kind of